Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. What you are about to hear is probably my opinion only in all the cosmos and galaxies and newly found planets. It is something I wrote, and I titled it At War in Astoria. And I'd like to start with a quote from Cynthia Bass from her book Sherman's March. 4 years of war is 40 years of anything else. 70 years ago tomorrow, the citizens of Astoria, Oregon, celebrated the end of World War II. The date was August 14, 1945. Japan had surrendered after atomic bombs obliterated two of its cities. For Astoria and the rest of the United States, it was Victory Over Japan Day, or simply VJ Day. Astoria is the oldest city in the American West. Its history is rough and stormy on both land and sea. Its myth-like golden age is perceived to have been in the late 19th century, when its riverfront, 10 miles inland from the Pacific Ocean, was crowded with ships from all over the world that exchanged the fineries of Victorian-era civilization for Columbia River salmon, timber from the bountiful forests, and wheat from farms along the lower river. Yet World War II might also be considered a period of great prosperity for the city, though it refrains from acknowledging war profiteering as part of its history. Astoria was intense during World War II. Thousands of sailors came from all over the USA to fill the crews of ships built upriver in Portland and Vancouver shipyards. Soldiers and Marines crowded into the city to be loaded aboard Navy troop ships as war cargo. Nearly all of them were young to war, aware they might be killed, their ships sunk, or they would die on a distant island. Astoria was their last stop in the continental USA, so they partied like there was no tomorrow, which for many, few tomorrows were left. World War II was the two-day war that lasted 6 years. It began on September 1st, 1939, and ended September 2nd, 1945. Between those 2 days were 6 years of the most tremendous and monstrous carnage ever experienced by humanity, which included the horrendous birth of the nuclear age that will most likely end dreadfully. World War II was the largest self-inflicted catastrophe in history and encompassed every continent except Antarctica. Its most enduring tragedy and legacy to the future is that it was nearly speciesidal. An estimated 50 to 60 million human beings perished out of existence during the 6 years the war spread over the world. Though soldiers, sailors, and airmen died by the millions, many more millions of civilians were killed in massive bombing air raids that destroyed cities or were exterminated in death camps as a result of their politics, religion, or race, as well as for sexual degeneracy, and that's a quote, and physical and mental disabilities. Hundreds of thousands at least were worked to death as prisoners and slaves. The war's immensity of death and broken lives, which can never be counted with complete accuracy nor truly comprehended, were approximately 15 million battle dead, 40 million civilian dead or missing, 35 million military and civilian wounded, 28 million homeless, and 11 million executed, which includes the abominable Holocaust of 6 million Jews exterminated in Nazi death camps, whose names will probably cause a shudder far into the future. Auschwitz, Treblinka, Dachau. To be understood and reachable to the individual sensibility, the war's enormous scale must be scaled back, focused on the microscopic yet very personal involvement. The Columbia River city of Astoria, Oregon, 10 miles inland from the Pacific Ocean, exemplified the war's urgent claim of total commitment of every nation swept into it, though its role was minor and supplementary compared to the large shipbuilding efforts 100 miles upriver in Portland and Vancouver. And of course, like every other city in the United States, it was untouched by actual combat. The initial effect of Pearl Harbor on Astoria was anxiety that the Japanese would attack the west coast of the United States, as so many rumors claimed. A severe blackout was imposed. Mines were laid at the entrance to the Columbia River to stop enemy ships and submarines, and incoming, outgoing, friendly vessels were escorted through the minefield by small Coast Guard patrol boats. Tongue Point-based Navy PBY seaplanes patrolled the north coast from San Francisco to the Straits of Juan de Fuca, which the PBYs were later replaced by Navy blimps that operated from Tillamook. Astoria's young men and women enlisted or were drafted into the armed forces, many joining the naval and maritime services, and were sent to all theaters of the war, Europe, Asia, and the Pacific. A National Guard unit from Astoria saw combat in New Guinea and the Philippines. The Navy built a 500-bed hospital for wounded servicemen, and Fort Stevens in Camp Clatsop, renamed Rylea, trained troops sent to Alaska and the Aleutian Islands. Although commercial fishing was made an immediate priority occupation in Astoria, not to be interrupted by drafting local fishermen away from the important war effort of supplying food for the armed forces, hundreds of local mariners flocked to enlist. Merchant Marine Liberty and Victory ships and Navy warships, such as the infamous Kaiser Coffins, small, thinly armored escort aircraft carriers were built upriver in Portland and Vancouver and floated downriver to Astoria to be commissioned, made sea-ready, and crammed to capacity with crews and cargoes of weapons, war supplies, and soldiers. Fully armed and crewed, these ships steamed out through the infamous Columbia River Bar into the vast Pacific Ocean to fight in the colossal oceanic war of annihilation against the Empire of Japan, many of whom never returned. Among many personal accounts of those first few months in Astoria after Pearl Harbor is one by Paul Barkman, who served on a Coast Guard patrol boat guarding the entrance to the Columbia River. "The river filled up with vessels of every kind," he wrote. "Ships anchored below Desdemona Light that had escaped Japanese submarines. A couple of ships were torpedoed just off the coast, but most managed to get across the bar and safely into harbor." "Everything was painted wartime gray," Barkman continued. "The Coast Guard vessels Fur, Manzanita, and Rose took on a drab appearance. Sea bags began to stack up at all naval and Coast Guard stations as floods of new enlistees took berths among the huge fleet of small craft that were taken over for the duration of the war. Yachts from the Astoria and Young's Bay clubs, tugboats and fishing boats of every sort were pressed into service and painted gray. Each received numerical designations based on their length, and most were mounted with guns." And that was Barkman. Like the rest of the country, the Oregon North Coast settled into a war routine of rationing, food, gas, sugar, and shoes, war bond drives, and blood banks, and very soon the War Department began sending telegrams to local families reporting the deaths of sons, brothers, husbands, and lovers. The deaths of American women grew apace of their military duties. People volunteered for the Red Cross and for air raid warden duties, worked on scrap drives, ration and draft boards, Robert S. Lovell wrote in the summer 1995 Cumtux, Clatsop County Historical Society's quarterly magazine. Women filled most of the cannery jobs previously held by able-bodied men and helped fit out ships sent incomplete to Astoria from the Upper River shipyards. Also exempt from the draft with fishermen were local ship and boatyard workers, marine electricians, and other skilled labor necessary to produce the local portion of the stupendous war machine that America built during World War II. Forest workers were not exempt, however, and while they warred all over the world, Pacific Northwest forests were left to burn untended except for skeleton crews of conscientious objectors, which included future Oregon poet William Stafford. A successful effort by local Chinese school children to block shipment of scrap iron to Japan in 1940, the year before Pearl Harbor, shouldn't be lost to our memory, Lovell wrote in Cumtux. Japanese atrocities in China angered the school children, who decided to picket a ship that was being loaded in Astoria. They suddenly appeared on the docks carrying signs, and our patriotic longshoremen decided to honor their picket line, Lovell wrote. The port of Astoria subsequently embargoed all further scrap shipments, which angered Japan. They're going to be shooting that stuff at us anyway, Lovell quoted his mother as saying, a rather popular opinion at the time. The Japanese sued the port, the longshoremen, and the Chinese children. Lovell wrote, fortunately, the suit dragged on and was settled when Pearl Harbor was bombed. Of course, it was only 27 months later that Japan did indeed shoot at Clatsop County with 17 shells aimed at Fort Stevens. Coast Guardsman Barkman wrote of the shelling of Fort Stevens. On the night of June 21, 1942, a Japanese submarine surfaced offshore and slammed a few shells at Fort Stevens. Everyone waited for Battery Russell to reply, but there was only silence. Afterward, the sub moved down the coast and shelled California. The Coast Guard anchored a barge off Fort Stevens and checked every vessel that went in and out of the river. Russian ships started coming in for cargo at ports upriver in large numbers, thrashing water on the way in and almost awash at the gunwales on the way out, Barkman wrote. It was a great shock at first to see women aboard the Soviet ships as members of the crews. The Columbia River Maritime Museum on the Astoria Riverfront provides a virtual, perhaps even visceral, experience of World War II's Titanic sea battles in the Pacific between the USA and Japan and the pitiless no-quarter submarine wars of 1914-18 and 1939-45 in the North Atlantic. The centerpiece of CRIM's Naval History Gallery is the steel bridge and pilot house of a U.S. Navy destroyer that experienced fierce combat in the colossal battles of the Pacific War. The museum was built around this 13-ton metal skull of USS Knapp, which, like a royal head, was detached from its body and shipped downriver from a Portland shipwrecking yard. A special corner of the Naval History Gallery is devoted to an exhibit of the heavy cruiser USS Astoria, including a model by CRIM founder Rolf Klepp. Astoria was the first of two warships named after the city of Astoria and was sunk by Japanese cruisers off Guadalcanal one August night in 1942 with three other Allied cruisers. The Battle of Savo Island was a nighttime gunfire and torpedo fight at which the Japanese excelled. Astoria, which had conveyed home to Tokyo the body of a Japanese ambassador a few years earlier, was riddled with shell hits. An all-metal, electronically guided, mechanically propelled warship engaged in the largest naval war in history, Astoria sank like an antique sailing man of war, gunned to death broadside to its enemy. 238 of Astoria's crew died with their ship. 142 were wounded. Above Klepp's model is a diagram showing where each of approximately 200 Japanese shells struck Astoria. A 50th anniversary reunion of survivors was held at the museum in 1992, and a number have been held since. They gather on August 9th, the date of Astoria's sinking, and also the date of the atomic bombing of Nagasaki in 1945. The plutonium for that bomb was manufactured upriver from Astoria at Hanford, Washington. Exhibits change and rotate in the Naval Gallery. One exhibit is the model of U.S. Navy destroyer Reuben James, generally considered the first American naval vessel lost in the war, though the gunboat Panay, sunk in China by Japanese air attack in 1937, might also have a claim. The Reuben James was torpedoed by a Nazi U-boat while escorting a convoy of cargo ships to England 2 months before Japan attacked Pearl Harbor in December 1941. Its loss characterized the grim six-year battle to maintain English and Russian ocean supply lines against attacking German submarines. Thousands of ships and lives were lost, and for a perilous time, U-boats sank more Allied cargo ships than could be replaced. In response, American shipyards revolutionized shipbuilding, particularly the Henry Kaiser yards on the Pacific coast. By war's end, the Kaiser yards in Portland and Vancouver were producing their famous Liberty and Victory ships, one a day. A classic example of a World War II Liberty ship is the Star of Oregon, which was built in Portland and launched in September 1941. It was the second Liberty launched, the first on the West Coast. A year later, on August 30, 1942, a Nazi submarine sent it to the bottom of the Caribbean on its return to the USA from its maiden voyage to the Persian Gulf. The Maritime Museum possesses a builder's model of Star of the Sea. The Kaiser Yards on the Columbia River also built warships, one of which was the escort aircraft carrier Gambier Bay. Krim's collection includes a model of Gambier Bay that was built from scratch by two Beaverton, Oregon dentists, Nick Marino and Robert Norgren, who singly or together made most of the naval models in the museum. The real Gambier Bay was one of 50 small aircraft carriers commissioned and crewed in Astoria. Escort carriers like Gambier Bay were built to provide air support for amphibious operations in the Pacific or against U-boats in the Atlantic. They carried a crew of 900, which, with their air squadrons of torpedo planes and fighters, joined aboard at Astoria. They were the first all-welded carriers, prefabricated to be built quickly, an average of one every 7 days. A popular name for them was Kaiser Coffins, which five commissioned in Astoria became, sunk by torpedoes, Japanese kamikazes, and one by surface fire. Paul Barkman wrote that although Astoria was generally a pleasantly quiet Liberty town, later in the war, when the escort carrier started coming downriver from the Kaiser shipyards in Portland and Vancouver, large numbers of shore patrol and local police were called out because too many of the crews aboard the Kaiser Coffins were not too optimistic about their futures and decided to tear up Astoria, which was their last American port. And that was Barkman. The late Fitz Randolph Moore used to say that during the war, many Astoria parents of young daughters were secretly grateful for the large influx of prostitutes from inland cities to entertain the sailors, marines, and soldiers, which apparently helped local girls remain virgin and unpregnant. The Gambier Bay has the unfortunate distinction of being the only American aircraft carrier sunk by surface fire. It was shot to pieces by Japanese battleships and cruisers at the Battle for Leyte Gulf in late October 1944, which was the largest sea battle in history and ended with the virtual destruction of the Japanese Navy. A spectacular victory for the USA despite heavy losses and serious blunders. As with the cruiser Astoria, survivors of Gambier Bay have met at Krim for reunions at the replica of their lost ship, a society of sudden swimmers. Rounding out the gallery's World War II fleet are photos on the walls of sailors on wartime sea duty, such as Astoria's crew members, and the radio broadcast of Franklin Roosevelt's Day of Infamy speech to Congress the day after Pearl Harbor, declaring war on Japan, is repeated interminably. A poignant yet routine sight of the war years in Astoria, when American servicemen crowded into the city and filled out Navy crews, aerial squadrons, and combat infantry shipped to hostile shores, was described by Paul Barkman, who died in the 1980s. One day in 1944, my patrol boat, which was about 50 miles offshore, spotted a large troop ship that had come out of the Columbia River and was heading across the Pacific. We could see hundreds of soldiers at the rails, staring at us, or looking back at the land many of them would never see again. I thought I knew how they felt and how they must have yearned to be in my place aboard a Coast Guard patrol boat that never left the United States or ever had a shot fired at it. The war against Nazi Germany ended on May 8, 1945, with the defeat and eradication of Nazism. Its periodic resurrections in various parts of the world, including the Pacific Northwest, are as yet out on the political fringe. The Pacific Ocean War came to a conclusion that summer, a few days after atomic bombs nuclearized two Japanese cities, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Japan surrendered to the Allies on August 14, 1945, and officially signed surrender documents aboard a U.S. battleship in Tokyo Harbor, the famous Missouri, on September 2nd. Both dates are claimed as the actual VJ Day. Robert Lovell wrote of Astoria at the end of the war, Troop ships began passing Astoria as the soldiers came home in the fall of 1945. You could hear their cheers all over downtown as the ships slowed to change pilots. In October 1945, Astoria played host to a small fleet of Navy ships that arrived just in time to celebrate Navy Day. They came from kamikaze action off Okinawa. Then on the way here, they encountered a terrible typhoon. You can visualize how glad they were to be here. And that was Lovell from Cumtux. Vestiges of World War II remain in Astoria. The balcony and wood dance floor of a nightclub that was crowded every night during the war years with servicemen and local ladies is part of a garage between a restaurant and a plumbing store. The war was at Tongue Point after the war, birthed a fleet of 500 mothballed ships that were dismantled or sent north to Puget Sound. Some retired a second time after reactivation for the Korean War of 1950-53. And of course, the old houses built all over the hills, the city's most conspicuous residences that have sheltered its population through two world wars, as well as the entire 20th century, and earlier when Astoria was a booming river port and its canned salmon a world-class delicacy. Like most cities worldwide, Astoria has a monument to the world wars. This one is a First World War American soldier scrambling through barbed wire with his infantry rifle held aloft, perhaps one of the very few national monuments erected over a public bathroom. The statue looks more completely a soldier when local pranksters stick an empty whiskey or wine bottle in his unoccupied hand. Compared to cities all over the world that were shattered by World War II, their populations decimated by bombs, fire, disease, starvation, forced removal, and extermination, Astoria's post-war problems were minor. It did not have to rebuild. That happened earlier, after the 1922 fire that gutted its downtown, or recreate its reasons for being a city. Its countryside, though ravaged by forest fires during the war years, had not been obliterated by savage combat or bombs. The war's end provoked an economic dislocation that was a microcosm of the early post-war nationwide. Astoria was without a manufacturing base and did not profit from the reconversion to consumer goods, though some of its markets and shops did. The Korean War caused a flurry of activity, but afterward the Navy abandoned its Tongue Point base. Even then, there were signs of the imminent collapse of the region's resource-based economies of logging and fishing. Perhaps that is why Robert Lovell's Cumtux, reminiscence of wartime Astoria, ended on a dismayed note. Our population still has not returned to the level of the 1940s, he said. World War II played out one last act in Astoria, however. The battleship USS Missouri visited the city in the late spring of 1998. It stayed for several days before being towed to join the sunken USS Arizona as bookend memorials to the beginning and ending of America's part in the war. An estimated 125,000 people came to see the old battleship before its last voyage. Such crowds will never be in Astoria again, unless, as one man suggested to the mayor, the city hosts the Olympics. Missouri left Astoria towed by a powerful tugboat, fittingly named Sea Victory, disappearing to a watchful crowd into fog that rolled up from the river's mouth. The old battleship towered over more recent Navy vessels, visiting the city before going upriver to Portland's annual Rose Festival. The moment the tug moved, Mighty Moe toward the ocean, another famous vessel, Astoria's own salvage chief, blasted its horn in tribute. Now, I have one more thing to read, and I guess I should claim that my disclaimer still is in effect. I call it Children of Satan, and I wrote it. Today, August 13th, is a sinister sop for the 13% of humanity who are in their wrong minds. If you are not aware or don't particularly care, today is International Left-Handedness Day. I am left-handed, which is easier to be than in the past. Catholic nuns vigorously attempted to make me right-handed when I started school and accused me of being a son of Satan when I refused. I don't know why most people are right-handed, Because they are. The right hand is the hand of sustenance and labor, and the vile left hand began its evil reputation in ancient times, when it was used to clean away the body's excrement. Thus, from antiquity has developed a sophisticated aversion to the left side of things. Prejudice against people who are left-handed predates more familiar bigotries of race, religion, nationality, gender, and homophobia. In every culture before record, all that is good and righteous has been accorded the right hand, while everything evil, vile, ugly, wrong-headed, or simply bad luck is the left. In politics, as well as society, a crude bicameral cleft is made between right and left. The established order that resists change is the political and cultural right, which usually defends itself with tradition, religion, and autocratic power. The political left is the force of change and reform that calls upon the future instead of the past and explores new ideas and innovative social and political approaches to greater freedom and well-being of the common citizenry. Left is about justice, not privilege. The left is the opposition. Once in power, it most usually reverts to the right. Reform, resistance, and rebellion to contemporary rule in the United States has since at least the Russian Revolution a century ago been called by assaulted authority leftist. A sinister, from Latin, sinus, meaning left or unlucky, hint at Bolshevik conspiracy, a suspicion of alien agents or homegrown dupes of foreign strategies to destroy the American way of life operating within its very heart. In other words, dissent and resistance to authority, injustice, and or inequality in this land of liberty, justice, and equality is implied to be treachery. Perhaps because of ancient and immediate hostility toward left-handed people, we are usually supporters of underdogs and outcasts and feel personally sympathetic to ideals of personal and political liberty. Left-handed people share with women and minority races and religions, also people with physical and mental disabilities, the problems of survival in a world designed with no consideration for their presence in it, or, much worse, designed to eradicate their presence. And just before I close down, I'd like to read a poem I wrote. Julie and VJ Day. You might have been named Victoria Jane. You knew a girl who was. Poor girl, you said. You are 70, VJ Day. The day you were born, the World War ended. Millions dead, gone. Nevermore, forever. You are new life, born amidst burial. A sad world you make warm. You unconditional mother. You wonderful woman. I love you always. Happy birthday, Julie. And this has been Michael McCusker.